the face of terror is not the true faith of Islam. That's not what Islam is all about. Islam is peace. These terrorists don't represent peace. They represent evil and war.
That was President George W. Bush speaking to the Islamic Center of Washington, D.C., less than a week after the terrorist attacks of September the 11th, 2001. That obviously is a very famous quote from President Bush. Islam is peace. We're going to be testing that assertion. It's not just from the president himself, but, of course, has become conventional wisdom in the United States and worldwide. We're going to be testing that assertion and other commonly held beliefs about Islam during this special hour of Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're coming to you live this Saturday evening, July the 10th. And we're going to be talking in the first hour of this special two-hour broadcast with Dr. Alvin Schmidt, who joins us here in Studio A. In the second hour of the program, we'll be talking with Dr. David Adams about creationism. Again, we're coming to you live this Saturday evening, July the 10th, and Issues Etc. is a live call-in talk show. So we invite your questions and your comments here in the first hour about Islam, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Feel free to call us anytime during this first hour with a question or a comment on Islam. And every caller during this hour will receive a book. This is a tremendous book called Is the Father of Jesus the God of Muhammad? Every caller in this hour with a question or a comment on Islam will receive that book, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We also have a live in-studio email address to take your questions and your comments during this and the next hour. It is issuesetc@kfuo.org, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Dr. Alvin Schmidt is our guest in the first hour. He's a regular guest here on Issues, Etc. He's a professor emeritus of sociology at Illinois College, author of several books, including his latest called The Great Divide. This is actually a forthcoming book, hot off the presses, but not in the stores yet, called The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West. Dr. Schmidt, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Thank you. My pleasure for being here.
First of all, your reaction to the comments made there in our opening by President George W. Bush almost three years ago now.
You know, when Jeff called me a couple of days ago about this interview, I anticipated that that question would come up. Let me address it in this way. When President Bush said that, first of all, I'd like to say I like President Bush as a leader and things that he's done to fight terrorism and the like, but I have to say on the basis of history and the basis of Quran and the basis of the Hadith and Sharia law, President Bush is wrong, as are many others. He's not the only one that has said this. For example, in my book that you just referenced, for example, he has said that, plus others have said something similar. Secretary Colin Powell said, for example, quote, I have learned about Islam as a religion of peace and caring, end of quote. Former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright under President Clinton said, and she chastised people for their, quote, appalling degree of ignorance about Islam, in other words, when they don't see it as a religion of peace. And even more recently, this last April, the ambassador, American Ambassador Paul Bremer in Baghdad, in response to the attack that brutally killed and burned four American civilians in Fallujah the day before, said on television that this atrocity was, quote, contrary to all the religions, including Islam. Well, they are wrong. They are wrong because, first of all, in this book I cite, there are many more, 35 passages in the appendix from the Quran itself, passages addressing, advocating violence. Let me read just a couple. And kill them wherever you find them, and drive them out from whence they drove you out. And persecution is severer than slaughter, and do not fight them at the sacred mosque until they fight with you in it. But if they fight, then slay them, such is the recompense of unbelievers. Another passage from Surah 2. By the way, Surah is a chapter in the Quran. There are 144 of them. Fighting is commanded to you, and it is an object of dislike to you, And it may be that you dislike a thing while it is good for you. And it may be that you love a thing while it is evil for you. And Allah knows while you do not know. Another passage from Surah 3. And if you are slain in the way of Allah or you die, certainly forgiveness from Allah and mercy is better than what they amass. Still another reference, if I may, from Surah 4. Our Lord, why hast thou ordained fighting for us? And one more, if I may, out of the 35 that I cite in the appendix. Then seize them and kill them wherever you find them, and take not from among them a friend or a helper.
Now, Dr. Schmidt, someone might respond, look, I could go through, say, the Old Testament of the Christian Bible, and I could find passages that perhaps in or out of their context would call for violence of a similar nature. How do you respond to that?
I'm glad you brought that question up. There are basically two fallacies in connection with that question. First of all, Christians live by the New Testament, and there's not a single violent passage advocated by anyone, Jesus or any of the apostles, as they are in the Quran. Secondly, the Quran passages are in the present tense. The Old Testament are in the past tense, 3,000 years old, 2,000 years old. So the point of comparison is totally flawed and can only, as I sometimes say, trip up uninformed, well-meaning Christians. And that's the intent in this case, because there's no similarity.
Late in your book, you talk about some of the best friends of Islam being both the Islamic apologists. We'll lay that aside for a moment. And you say modern Western political correctness. Is that why these references to Islam as a religion of peace are historically rather recent?
Yes, because one goes back, for example, and reads about Islamic scholars of Muhammad or Islam from the mid-1700s on all the way through basically to today, you find very few people defending Islam. In fact, most of them have called it. Even the person who does kind of sort of defend Islam in some way, Edward Gibbon, the man who wrote The Decline and the Fall of the Roman Empire, and said, for example, that Muhammad walked with the Quran in one hand and the sword in the other. Very, very true. And I might also cite a recent, she's been on television once or twice, on the O'Reilly show, for example. She's a Muslim woman, lives in Toronto. Her name is Irshad Manji. And here's what she says as a critic of Islam. Pick a Muslim country, she says, any Muslim country, and the most brutal humiliations will grab you by the vitals. In Pakistan, an average of two women every day die from quote-unquote honor killings, often with Allah's name on the lips of the murderers. In Mali, in Mauritania, little boys are seduced into slavery by Muslim hustlers. In Sudan, slavery happens at the hands of Islamic militias. In Yemen and Jordan, Christian humanitarian workers have been shot point blank. In Bangladesh, artists who advocate for the rights of religious minorities have been locked up or driven out of the country altogether. It's all documented, she says. Here is not an outsider, but an insider.
That raises a question. And why are there, I can understand an Islamic country under Sharia law, why there would be virtually no public critics of Islam. But why in the West, when there is religious freedom and freedom of speech, do we still find so few public critics of Islam?
Well, because basically many Muslims fear safety for their lives. This is why many of them who, for example, Ibn Warraq, who wrote a book, Why I'm Not a Muslim, a former Muslim, Ibn Warraq is a pseudonym. For example, Bat Eeyore, who lives in Switzerland, operates under a pseudonym, and many others that I could cite. Because they, even for example, Irshad Manji, whom I just quoted, has installed in her house bulletproof glass and guards around her. It's one thing for a non-Muslim to critique and criticize Islam. It's quite more serious for a Muslim to do so. Actually, they call upon themselves, they're apostates, and therefore deserve the death penalty.
Now, let's do the briefest, because you could give us the entire rest of the hour, probably just from memory, the history of Islam. Give us the briefest sketch of Islam's history to bring us up to date. And if you would, in the course of that history, show us how, in a sense, we've gotten where we are today, with Islam being virtually unknown until it breaks onto the world scene in the West with terrorist attacks.
Yes, I'll mention a few incidents. For example, in 622, when Muhammad took his Hajira from Mecca to Medina, he changed his tactics. Previous to that, he wanted to get converts by means of peaceful persuasion. It was not successful. So he was persecuted, for example, in Mecca, his town where he was born and raised. So he went to Medina, and as he went to Medina, he changed his tactics and said he will now use the sword, and he has done so. He died in 632. His successor, by the name of Abu Bakr, who was only 2 years as a caliph, began to invade Palestine. And then the successor to him, by the way, Abu Bakr was murdered. The successor to him then, by the name of Umar, then invaded Palestine, Jerusalem, 638, many other areas, basically the whole area of what's called the Levant, the countries east of the Mediterranean, and then proceeded to northern Africa. And by the year, within less than 100 years, they had occupied the whole area of what we would call Palestine, Syria, Persia, and the northern shores of Africa. Then in 711, actually 10 and 11, they went across the Straits of Gibraltar and invaded Spain, conquered it, lived there basically for 800 years. Spain was minding its own business. And in 711, when the city of Toledo, by the way, was captured by a fellow by the name of Tariq, and Toledo, by the way, was once had 18 Christian church councils from 400 to 702 that met there, he took prisoners, cut them in pieces, boiled their flesh in cauldrons, and then told the remaining Spaniards, now go tell what has happened to people who don't cooperate with us.
So within less than 100 years of the founding of Islam in 622 A.D., it has, as a conquering force, a conquering philosophy and religious impulse, found its way all the way from the Middle East to the very western edge of Europe as a conquering force.
Quite right. And while it was in Spain, in 732, they invaded into what we would call France today, Goth and those areas. And at the Battle of Poitiers, or Tours, as the English call it, they were on a forward march to capture Western Europe in addition to Spain. Except that they ran into opposition with Charles Martel, who happened to be the grandfather of Charlemagne the Great. He beat him. He beat them royally. And why did he beat him? Because the Muslims, as in many ways to this day, the Islam lagged far behind science. His men had developed a saddle with stirrups in them. And so they came with lances that were 10, 12 feet long, and the Muslims had swords that were 3, 4 feet long. And he annihilated them. Had that battle not taken place, and historians of all sorts say, they would have conquered all of Europe, and we would have never had any cathedrals. We would have had mosques instead of cathedrals.
Interesting thing to think about. It is Saturday evening, July the 10th. You are listening to a live special broadcast of Issues Etc. Dr. Alvin Schmidt is our guest. We're talking about Islam. If you have a question or comment on Islam, give us a call, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Everyone who calls us tonight with a question or a comment for Dr. Schmidt on Islam in this first hour will receive the book, Is the Father of Jesus the God of Mohammed? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And our live in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Dr. Schmidt, a mutual friend of ours, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, who's a Christian apologist and international human rights attorney, many other things, offered this explanation on why Muslims in the West don't appear as radical as Muslims in other parts of the world.
Well, it's interesting to see the difference when Muslims are in the minority in a country or they are in the majority and control it. When he was in Mecca, Muhammad was surrounded by enemies. He was in a minority position. At that point, he preached tolerance. He says there is no compulsion in religion. The moment that Muslims took a majority position in any country, right away, religious freedom has disappeared. And this shows perfectly well that the vast majority of Muslims who are living in tolerant Western societies are living the same kind of tolerant life that is characteristic of their societies. But the moment that they enter into a position of power where they can force their religion on others, they have invariably, through the centuries, done this. And not only have they done it, but they have made life utterly miserable for people of other religious beliefs. Forced conversions has been the history of Islam. So it simply depends upon the situation in which they find themselves. This is one of those sad situations. It's something like the problem that existed with Marxism, that when Marxists were in democratic societies, they used the democratic society in order to promote their viewpoint. But their object in all of this was to create a society where their own viewpoint was the only one.
Dr. Schmidt, your reaction, your thoughts in reaction to the words of Dr. John Warwick Montgomery.
Essentially, that's correct, but one has to qualify that. That, in many ways, was the past. That has changed drastically now with terrorism. Now Muslims within countries where they don't have control, where they don't have power, are now attacking people. Previous in history, they typically didn't, but this is changing now. And so, really, it's a change for the worse.
Let's see if we can connect the dots there and then talk a little bit about some of the claims that are popularly made here in the West about Islam and go through them one by one to wrap up this segment of our conversation. When you hear someone say that Islam is a religion of peace, and then when someone says, okay, we've got terrorists who they're not representing Islam. When someone says this, now we've heard from you the pretty bloody history of the first 100 years at the very least. And we have heard Dr. Montgomery's rehearsal there as well. Is terrorism something foreign to Islam as a religion?
No, it isn't. In fact, you can say that it began with Muhammad himself. Muhammad himself killed people with the sword. There is a case, for example, of Qab ibn Sharaf, who, for example, whom he did not like. So he had people kill him, then brought him and tossed the head at his feet, and then he praised Allah for it. So the thing goes all the way back to Muhammad. This is nothing new. And the pages of history are filled with it. The question you have to ask people sometimes, what is the symbol of Islam? The sword, my friend. You know, and this in itself tells us an awful lot. The scimitar, if you will, the curved sword. And then also, if you think of the violence in Muslims, it is not just, for example, that they invaded and in 732 were beat. In 1529, they were invading southeastern Europe, not southwestern now, standing at the gates of Vienna. They lost. And then, and by the way, in previous to that, they had already captured from the late 1300s the areas that we call Hungary, Bulgaria, Bosnia, Kosovo. The Muslims you have in there all came about from the late 1300s, early 1400s. And then 1683, they tried to capture Vienna one more time. And again, they failed. These were basically the Ottoman Turks or the Muslims under the Ottoman Turks. So the violence continued. Also, I might mention, the violence continued long after the Crusades were over. It continued right into the mid-19th century.
So how do you explain that, especially in the West, and let's speak to our context, the United States of America, there are, of the very small number, relatively speaking, Muslims in our country, there are not, at least in evidence, the same kind of radical impulses, ideas, at least on the surface, that we find in Islamic countries or, as you pointed out, in countries where terrorism has its way. Why does it seem to be peaceful in the West, Islam?
In the West or in this country?
In this country, I'm sorry.
Well, first of all, because they're a massive minority. Muslims make up roughly 2 to 3% of the population, contrary to what you hear. They're about the size of the Jewish population in this country, maybe a little bit more, which means about 6 million people. The figure that you see, 12 million, so are totally inflated, that simply don't correspond to the statistics, and I've checked them out. So they're a minority. But also, let's remember this. The silence of Muslims in this country has been deafening. Where have they been? And those few that have spoken, as I cite in the book, have spoken in such a manner that both sides could take comfort from what they said. They didn't come out clear and explicitly condemning terrorism or the acts that they have done. Why? I suppose two reasons. One, because they may fear other Muslims if they did so. And two, they may have a sympathy for what happened.
With only a minute before we have to go to our first break here, Dr. Schmidt, you also have almost an entire chapter on the combination of the use of force, of conquest, and the proselytizing nature of Islam. Is this conquering toward the end of forced conversion?
Yes, one of the things that was most amazing to me, and it's hard for me to fathom it, to understand, when you read some historians, it is like they have blinders on their eyes. We'll say, for example, Muslims have never forced anyone to convert. Well, you heard Dr. Montgomery say, but I document with sources over the years, even now, for example, in Indonesia, where individuals have been forced to convert, boys have been taken and forcefully circumcised and threatened, 5,000 of them sometimes in cases, to either die or convert to Islam. The pages of history are full of it. And when some historians say there has never been any forced conversion, and you just say, I don't understand how you can say this. What else can I say? It simply doesn't square with the facts of history. Proselytizing by force. By the way, and many times they were proselytized also besides force. There was the tax of jizya, G-I-Z-A-H. For example, it's a tax that a non-Muslim had to pay. But if you converted, you didn't have to pay that tax. So you had an indirect forced conversion taking place. You had forced conversion, for example, that occurred by the thousands in the Devshirme system, which came in under the Ottoman Turks in the late 1300s and existed till almost to 1700, where boys were taken, Christian boys were taken and usually in their teenage years, forced to become soldiers. Slave soldiers could never marry. They were the elite soldiers and so forth, but they all had to become Muslims. They had no choice. So here you have another example. So the pages of history are filled with forced conversion right to the present day.
Dr. Alvin Schmidt is our guest. We're talking about Islam during this live special broadcast, Saturday evening, July the 10th, here on Issues, etc. Our call-in numbers, we'll be taking some of your phone calls here on the other side of the break. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Alvin Schmidt is Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College. He's author of several books, including his forthcoming book, The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And every caller who has a question or comment for Dr. Schmidt in this hour will receive a copy of the book, Is the Father of Jesus the God of Mohammed? Then, in the second hour of this special live broadcast here this Saturday evening, July the 10th, we're going to be talking with Dr. David Adams of Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis about creationism. We'll be right back after this.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, etc.
You've heard the word fascism. But do you know what fascism is? If not, you need our Issues, Etc. book of the month for July, Modern Fascism, by Dr. Jean Edward Veith. Did fascism die with Hitler and Mussolini? Find out by reading Modern Fascism, our Issues, Etc. book of the month for July. You can order Modern Fascism by calling Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours. Their toll-free number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. You can also check out the book before you buy it by visiting our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section of the website, you'll find Modern Fascism by Dr. Jean Edward Veith. It's our Issues, Etc. book of the month for July, 1-800-325-3040, issuesetc.org.
Now this Global Minute highlights one of the world's largest cities so you can pray for people living there. at São Paulo, Brazil, which has 11 million people within the city limits and up to 20 million people in the greater metro area. The entire sprawling region covers 70 miles. Missionary Ted Limbick with OC International describes the challenges of urban life. He writes that just about everybody he knows has been robbed at least once. Beggars are stationed at intersection after intersection asking for help. But there's good news. The gospel continues capturing hearts and changing lives in São Paulo and throughout the country. Limpic writes that for every baby born, five Brazilians are born again. The evangelical church is growing at five times the rate of the population. Pray for more Brazilians to yield to Jesus Christ. Get prayer updates and news from around the globe by visiting the website missionvisionnetwork.org. That's missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. About church bells. My home church had the practice of ringing the church bell every Saturday night. That was not for Saturday service. They didn't have that. But to remind the community that the next day was Sunday worship. Hearing that bell gave me a sense of order, of a place in time, and a sense of community. Karl Barth wrote, "On Sunday morning, when the bells ring to call the congregation and minister to church, there is in the air an expectancy that something great, crucial, and even momentous is to happen. What happens is that God Himself is present. God Himself is present with His people through the Word and sacraments of Christ." And during that momentous presence, many churches toll the bell during the Lord's Prayer, the Our Father. That old custom made it possible for those who were physically unable to go to church to pray along with the assembled congregation. Again, a sense of order, a sense of community. 1 Corinthians 13:1 says, "If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I am only a resounding gong." Don't let the church bell be an empty sound in your life. It's an invitation to an order in life and to the presence of love. I'm Dale Meyer.
Please consider supporting AM 850 KFUO with a financial gift. AM 850 KFUO is funded by listeners like you who enjoy the original and totally Christ-centered programming they hear on AM 850 KFUO each and every day. Contact Janelle Flurkey at 314-996-1655 or go to our website and click the support button. Thanks for your prayerful consideration.
One of many instances, as you know, in the recent history by terrorists who have done so in the name of Islam. And like we've said before, we'll say it again, they do not reflect our values, they do not reflect our religion. In fact, everything they do oppose is in opposition with what Islam stands for.
That was a representative of CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations, reacting to, if you will remember this, the first of several beheadings, the first one being the beheading last April of Nicholas Berg, her reaction saying it had nothing to do with Islam. We're talking about Islam during this special hour of Issues, Etc. here Saturday evening, July the 10th. Dr. Alvin Schmidt is our guest. He's professor emeritus of sociology at Illinois College and author of several books, including his latest, the forthcoming The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam, and The Triumph of the West. Feel free to give us a call. We have a couple open phone lines here, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Let's go to the phones. First up, calling from St. Louis, Ruthie is on the line. Ruthie, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, thanks for the subject. A comment and then a question. It seems like the elephant in the living room. I mean, everything points to Islam being a troublesome religion, but everyone is in complete denial, and except for Christian radio and a few seculars. So thank you for being on the forefront. My question is, I have a lot of Muslim friends or friends that think that Muslims are very peaceful, and they always refer to the Crusades and abortion clinic bombings for what we Christians do. and I'm really tired of it, and what's the best response?
Thank you very much. Two good things there, Ruthie. First of all, why is there such silence in most sectors on what she calls the troublesome elements of Islam?
I mean, on the part of Islam, on part of the Muslims, why is there silence?
I would say on the part of the academy, the government, educational institutions.
There are two reasons. One is obviously we are living under a pervasive influence, political ideology called political correctness, where, for example, you can no longer speak the truth, no matter how truth is. That's why I have a section in here, the facts be damned. And I point out how the facts are there, but they're damned, if you will, because you cannot speak about them. You're immediately accused of hate crime and bigotry and whatnot all. Well, you know, that same kind of argument could be used to say, for example, the Nazis never did what they did either. You know, people can deny things and still not fit history. And this is what's the case here. But to go back to the lady's question or comment about, for example, why do Christians did the Crusades and abortion bombing? First of all, you have to remember Muslims, Islam people define Christians extremely broadly. Everybody in America is seen as a Christian who isn't a Muslim. They do not define Christians as we would Christian, namely those who believe and confess Jesus Christ, rather than those who are nominal Christians or, you know, Christians in, well, name only, which is nominal. And so there's a flaw right there. And secondly, even when Christians engage in violence, they are then violating Christian values and ethics, and nothing in Christendom will defend what they do, which is not true in Islam. They have all the defense on their side for engaging in violence because the Quran is filled for it. And let me just add something else. So very frequently people are misled, but that's not in the Quran. Yeah, but however, maybe it's in the Hadith. The Hadith consists of 9 large volumes. And what's not in the Quran is typically in the Hadith. And that is as authoritative as is the Quran. Or if it's not in these two, then it's probably in reliance of the traveler with the Sharia that represents 85% of the Muslims. That's a 1,200-page book, which, for example, spells out the sentences for apostasy, how you punish them, stone them, and whatnot all. So the idea, again, is that many people do not know what Islam stands for, and I don't mean to be immodest. Many Christians don't know what Christianity stands for, so obviously they wouldn't know a religion outside of Christianity either.
Let's talk with Eugene, who listens in Billings, Montana, listening on the Internet. Eugene, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yes. Hello.
Eugene, you got a question or comment for Dr. Schmidt?
Yes, I taught a Bible class on the subject of Islam, and I just wondered how much does the end justify the means play into this whole subject?
You mean from the Muslims' perspective, Eugene?
Pardon me?
From the Muslims' perspective, the end justifies the means?
Yes, from the Muslim perspective, how much does the end justify the mean play into this whole
subject? All the way. That is exactly what they operate with. The end justifies the means.
Explain that, if you would.
Well, if you need to kill somebody to accomplish a given purpose, you do it, because the end is meritorious. It's a philosophy that the communists operated with, and it was defended by the communists. Lenin, for example, the first dictator of the Soviet Union, after the Russian Revolution of 1917, when people criticized the end justifies the means, you know what he said in response? And I'm going to quote him. If the end doesn't justify the means, what the H does? And that's exactly how the Muslims operate. They don't particularly quote that passage, but their actions throughout history clearly demonstrate that.
David is calling from Illinois. David, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you. Three things. One, I had a class in St. Louis on different faiths, and a cleric came and addressed the class, and the question was asked to him, you know, do you believe in killing? He says, well, we certainly believe in killing our enemies. And I thought that was kind of bold. But two things. Why aren't we hearing this really being preached from the pulpit? It seems to me that Islam could be preached as the devil, and you know, and we're saved through Jesus Christ. That's a question. And then, usually we could not profile, and we're starting to profile in the country now, and I think it's excellent, and I think it should be done every day, all day. Again, I guess it gets to that political correctness, but, you know, why shouldn't we profile, and why isn't the church supporting this?
Good questions, David. Let's see what Dr. Schmidt has to say.
Why don't pastors preach about it? Well, it depends. I suppose you could make, I don't want to be sound uncharitable. First of all, I think many pastors themselves do not really know what Islam really stands for, except a little bit superficially. And then there is the pervasive atmosphere that is set of political correctness, which means you cannot profile, which to me is the dumbest thing you can be. I was once a member of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. And if you don't operate with profiling, no matter what it is, you are dumb. You're not going to, for example, catch the criminal. It just defies common sense. But one thing I have also learned over the years, that common sense is not very common. And, of course, this is true with political correctness. It overshadows common sense.
The caller asked, why silence from our pastors on the true nature of Islam? Dr. Schmidt, some pastors say that Christians and Muslims worship the same God. How do you respond to that?
Well, that's kind of an easy question to answer. First of all, no, they don't. And why not? First of all, they deny that Jesus Christ was crucified. Therefore, they deny the resurrection. They deny, refuse to accept that the Trinity, so they can't be worshiping the same God. We worship Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. They deny the Trinity. The very phrase, Son of God, is repugnant to them. So in no way do they worship the same God, because they reject the Trinity, they reject the crucifixion, they reject, for example, the resurrection thereby, and so on. So no, we're not worshiping the same God. This is, again, an example of political correctness, or what else I might call it, even before political correctness, perhaps people believe it somehow that all gods are equal. Says who? The good scripture doesn't say that. Christ himself didn't say it when he said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father but by me. Or when he said to Philip, when he asked him, show us the Father, what did he say in John 8? He was seeing me as seeing the Father. In other words, he was saying, you dummy, you're looking at him. No, we're not worshiping the same God.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Up next, calling from Illinois, Herman is on the line. Herman, thank you for waiting, and welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you for taking my call. I would like to ask Dr. Schmidt how he would see perhaps a dialectic involved here. Luther had an emphasis on trying to get the gospel to the Muslims, and I believe he also translated or had translated a work by an earlier monk that explained the differences between Islam and Christianity and showed the points of error there. And yet also there appear to be times where civil order is necessary, like at the Battle of Tours and before the gates of Vienna, and now in the war on terrorism, at least to keep the violent force of Islam in check so that the gospel can be preached. How would you see that interrelated today, Dr. Schmidt?
Herman, thanks.
Well, obviously, we as Christians always want to preach the gospel to people. That's our main reason for, you know, preach the gospel to people. It's very difficult to do, for example, in a Muslim country, because if you do, you won't be doing it long. You'll take your life in your hands. It's impossible. For example, go to Saudi Arabia. You can't even wear a Christian cross. The Red Cross must disguise the symbol of the Red Cross on its ambulances and the like. Churches cannot be built. Christians cannot worship in their own home, may not have a Bible in their own home. So it's very difficult in some countries to preach the gospel. They do it surreptitiously, secretly here and there. But every time they do it in countries like Saudi Arabia or even in other countries, they're taking their life in their hands. But we must do it.
Kevin is calling from his car. Kevin, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I guess my question is really about, in Christianity, there's many, many different denominations. Would the Nation of Islam be considered a denomination of Islam, and would they follow the same teachings, or are they more of a Islamic cult?
You mean the group within the United States called the Nation of Islam under Farrakhan?
Yes.
Well, there's debate about it. Many Muslims until recently, and even now I'm not sure, used to not accept them as Islamic people. Some sectors of Islam apparently they now do. But that's about the best I can say on that. Are they genuinely like the other Muslims? Well, there's certain things that, by the way, that they have in common with all other Muslims. We don't hear too much about it. We've heard about it from Farrakhan. Farrakhan is anti-Semitic. So is the Islamic religion. It was there from Muhammad on, and I cite numerous examples in the upcoming book, how, for example, the politically correct people ignore the anti-Semitic feature of Islam.
Dr. Alvin Schmidt is our guest. We're talking about Islam here during this special broadcast of Issues, Etc., coming to you live Saturday evening here, July the 10th. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Adela's on the line calling from Bridgeton. Adela, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I would like to know if there's any connection at all between Islam and the sect or organization here in the United States that are lodge members.
Thank you, Adela. Well, she's pretty much struck on two of your areas of expertise there, both Islam and Masonic organizations.
Well, she didn't say Masonic. She said lodge, which makes it even broader. As far as I know, no. I have to qualify that maybe just a little bit. Symbolically, the Shriners use symbolism from the Arabs, but not from Islam. So that's about the closest we can get to that.
So it's a superficial similarity, a symbolic superficial.
For the Shriners, which is an organization, you have to be a Mason to become a Shriner. But they use, well, you know, they use the fez hat and the like, and they have scimitar symbols and the like many times on their Scottish Rite buildings and whatnot all. But they do not follow Islam, to my knowledge, everything that I've read about them, no.
And I think he's read quite a bit about those. You have a book on that, don't you? Somewhere back in your past. Carol is calling from St. Louis. Carol, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hello.
Hi, Carol. Hello, Carol.
Yes. I'm a woman of few words. I want to say thank you, thank you, thank you. Because you're honest, you're true, and your facts are right. And the problem in this country, unfortunately, is that many people have not really been educated about this religion. I was fortunate enough to have a fantastic education and knew about Muhammad and everything that you've said and all of the wars these people have caused. And if anyone thinks they can deal with these people in a Christian way, well, they will lose their head. Now, I don't want to be rude or awful, but I just want to say thank you.
Carol, thank you very much. We appreciate you appreciating what we're doing here on Issues, Etc. One of the things, you end up sounding, you've talked about political correctness a lot here during this hour's conversation and how it tends to tamp down any criticism or even any critical thought about Islam as a religion. Just the simple things that you've been saying, that you say in your book, can come across sounding to the public ear very harsh, very judgmental. How do you respond to that?
Well, you know, with Christians, we always want to speak the truth in love. And even when one does, it is never going to be perceived as doing it in love when people have a strong political agenda that basically operate with the old saying, don't confuse me with any facts, my mind is made up. And that's a great deal behind political correctness. I might also mention, for instance, that when you talk about profiling, as we referred to before, when you watch an airport, an 85-year-old white woman will be searched as though, and I have never seen an 85-year-old white woman or whatever color she might be, hijack a plane. Just recently, my son's wife was flying from Memphis to Washington, D.C. She had a little four-month baby on her arm. She was searched as though she was a possible terrorist, picked at random. This is the stupidity, if I may argue, of not trying to profile people.
We still have 10 minutes left in our conversation on Islam with Dr. Alvin Schmidt. Our call-in number is 505-7850. 1-800-730-2727. Every call during this hour with a question or a comment for Dr. Schmidt on Islam will receive the book, Is the Father of Jesus the God of Muhammad? I'd like your reaction to another comment made by President George W. Bush. This one more recent. This was at his last live primetime press conference. His initial remarks included this.
Our terrorist enemies have a vision that guides and explains all their varied acts of murder. They seek to impose Taliban-like rule, country by country, across the greater Middle East. They seek the total control of every person and mind and soul. A harsh society in which women are voiceless and brutalized. None of this is the expression of a religion. It is a totalitarian political ideology pursued with consuming zeal and without conscience.
President George W. Bush's recent comments at a live press conference, prime time. I'm certain you heard that when those comments were made. Your reaction when he says what the terrorists, he says the terrorists have in mind there, all the oppressive things, is not the result of a religion but of simple political ideology.
Well, you know, even if you want to pick up that argument, what percentage of the Muslim population in the Middle East is terrorist? There's been estimates that it's at least 150,000 minimally. That's hardly a small minority. These are estimates. As I remember, Daniel Pipes, who's written a great deal about this, gives that particular figure. Also, when we hear, for example, this unfortunate statement that it's basically a religion of peace, all I have to say, the facts of history don't support that argument. From the very beginning, it was a religion of violence. Muhammad himself said, I will now use the sword, and he did. And it has not stopped. Granted, at times, for example, there was peace and relative tranquility. But when they tried to conquer southwestern Europe, then eastern Europe, and had already conquered the Levant area, the northern Africa, Islam's goal is to Islamize the entire world, and they will do it by force, because for the most part, persuasion has not worked well. And so to say it's a religion of peace and that it's only the terrorists that are going astray, I only have to say, please read the Quran, read the Hadith, and read the Sharia, which I do not think these people have read.
Dr. Schmidt, the light bulb went on for me. I've had many conversations in the course of doing this program on Islam in the last several years. And the light bulb went on for me when one of the guests pointed out that Islam has no, we would put it in Lutheran terms, no two-kingdom theology. They do not distinguish between the mosque and the state, between, if you will, church and state. Talk about that,
right,
if you would.
Right. I, in the book, call the church and the state and the mosque Siamese twins. They cannot be separated because in Islam, the state is the religion and religion is the state. Anything, even, what's his name, Bernard Lewis, the American expert, a retired professor at Princeton University, says that it's a heresy for Islam to think about separating church and state or mosque and state. It cannot be done. You defy every rule from the Quran through the Hadith through Sharia. And so when people think that this will happen under Muslims in this country, I simply have to say I think they're living in a dream world.
So does this also not only explain why Muslim nations look the way they do? That is, everything seems to have a religious element to it. Even the most civil activities have a religious element. But also why clerics in these countries, the imams who speak for mosques, seem to speak with a louder, more authoritative voice than the government does?
Yes, because, again, they are basically, in many ways, leaders of the government. You know, the early caliphs that we had, for example, they were all ardent Muslims. And many of the imams that we have today are basically as politically oriented as politicians who don't carry a religious label.
With only a minute here before we have to wrap up our conversation, Dr. Schmidt, what is at stake if we as a people, if our leaders, if we as a church fail to understand the true nature of Islam? What's at stake?
We may very well become an Islamic state. There was a book that was published in 1989 by a Muslim American. Siddiqui is his name. The book has not been widely circulated, but I got my hands on it. He predicted in 1989 that in 25 years, America would be living under Sharia law. Now, maybe that's a little bit of a stretch. That's what, about 10 years away from now. And let me explain why this is not necessarily a pipe dream on their part.
With less than a minute here.
Okay. We live in an age where everything has been relative. We are religiously ignorant about Christianity. And if all religions are equal, all cultures equal, well, what great harm would there be if we lived under Islam? And so I can see it happening. We have already adopted, just a month ago in May, officially in the town of Hamtramck, suburban Detroit, a Sharia law unanimously voted by the city council, that the Sharia law of calling in Arabic the Muslim prayers five times a day is now permitted in Hamtramck, Michigan. So you have the beginning, you might say, of Sharia law beginning to take its place. I hope and pray it doesn't happen, but I would not, if I lived till 2015 or 20, be surprised if it did happen, because we have lost our theological, our rational mooring, so to speak.
Dr. Alvin Schmidt, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues, Etc.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Dr. Alvin Schmidt is Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College. He's author of several books, including his latest, it will be out very soon, called The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam, and The Triumph of the West. Well, we could go on to talk about what's at stake, and we could go on to talk about foreign policy, not just domestic affairs, but foreign policy. But perhaps, no, not perhaps, most certainly, more importantly, if the church fails to see the true nature of Islam, we will continue buying into permitting and listening when we hear pastors say, well, you know, the God of Islam, the God of Christianity are essentially the same thing. Nothing could be farther from the truth. The God of Islam is not the God of Christianity. The God of Christianity has revealed himself in one and one way only, through his incarnate Son, Jesus Christ, crucified and risen again for a sinful world. Apart from that Christ, sinners perish eternally. See, that is the bad news that Islam may recognize, but it doesn't have the answer for. Christ does. His perfect life, his death, and his resurrection not only show him to be the true revelation of the true God, but also, as Dr. Schmidt quoted him earlier, the way, the truth, and the life by whom all men come to the Father. When we come back, we'll talk about creationism with Dr. David Adams.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.